This is June 27th, 2010, and for the Teisho this morning, I'm going to offer up some reflections on contentment. This is a topic that has come to me many times in my mind as I have seen over the years contentment growing in myself, contentment in my marriage, and it's worth addressing, because it's perhaps not as simple as it may seem. I'd like to start by reading parts of a David Brooks column that appeared in the New York Times. This is in the spring. He called it the Sandra Bullock trade. Trade-off, really, is what he means. He begins, "Two things happened to Sandra Bullock this month. First, she won an Academy Award for Best Actress. Then came the news reports claiming that her husband is an adulterous jerk. So the philosophic question of the day is, would you take that as a deal? Would you exchange a tremendous professional triumph for a severe personal blow?" And he says, "If you had to take more than 3 seconds to think about this question, you are absolutely crazy. Marital happiness is far more important than anything else in determining personal well-being. If you have a successful marriage, it doesn't matter how many professional setbacks you endure, you will be reasonably happy. If you have an unsuccessful marriage, it doesn't matter how many career triumphs you record, you will remain significantly unfulfilled." This isn't just sermonizing. This is the age of research, so there's data to back this up. Over the past few decades, teams of researchers have been studying happiness. Their work, which seemed flimsy at first, has developed an impressive rigor, and one of the key findings is that, just as the old sages predicted, worldly success has shallow roots, while interpersonal bonds permeate through and through. And then he talks about measures of happiness among different nations compared to gross national product and average income. He says, "On a personal scale, winning the lottery doesn't seem to produce lasting gains in well-being. People aren't happiest during the years when they are winning the most promotions. Instead, people are happy in their 20s, dip in middle age, and then on average hit peak happiness just after retirement at age 65. People get slightly happier as they climb the income scale, but this depends on how they experience growth. Does wealth inflame unrealistic expectations? Does it destabilize settled relationships? Or does it flow from a virtuous cycle in which an interesting job produces hard work that in turn leads to more interesting opportunities?" If the relationship between money and well-being is complicated, the correspondence between personal relationships and happiness is not. The daily activities most associated with happiness are sex, socializing after work, and having dinner with others. The daily activity most injurious to happiness is commuting. You know, we're very lucky here in Rochester. Last I heard, fairly recently, a couple years ago, Rochester ranked number one in the country, all cities in the country, for the lowest commute time, average commute time. Uh, According to one study, joining a group that meets even just once a month produces the same happiness gain as doubling your income. This is important stuff to consider when deciding whether to come to the center on a Sunday morning, for example. According to another, being married produces a psychic gain equivalent to more than $100,000 a year. If you want to find a good place to live, just ask people if they trust their neighbors. Levels of social trust vary enormously, but countries with high social trust have happier people, better health, more efficient government, more economic growth, and less fear of crime. The overall impression from this research is that economic and professional success exists on the surface of life and that they emerge out of interpersonal relationships which are much deeper and more important. The second impression is that most of us pay attention to the wrong things. Most people vastly overestimate the extent to which more money would improve our lives. Most schools and colleges spend too much time preparing students for careers and not enough preparing them to make social decisions. Most governments release a ton of data on economic trends, but not enough on trust and other social conditions. In short, modern societies have developed vast institutions oriented around the things that are easy to count, not around the things that matter most. They have an affinity for material concerns and a primordial fear of moral and social ones. And then he says this may be changing, and he mentions a couple books. But so it would seem from the research that he presents that all we have to do is find the right partner and the right relationships, social relationships, and land in the right neighborhood, and things will be okay. Well, we know that however okay they may be for a while, that won't last. At least it won't last to the same extent. A dictionary definition of content: happy enough with what one has or is, not desiring anything more or different, satisfied. Well, this is all very well, and this is in practicing, in a spiritual practice, we hardly want people to suffer meaninglessly. But the problem with contentment, we know what's wonderful about contentment, but the problem with it is it can undermine one's aspiration to go beyond one's temporary contentment. Because all contentment is temporary, isn't it? Certainly, when we die, how content can we be? Well, people die, have good deaths. Roshi Kaplow was one of the most of content deaths of all. But still, most people can't remain content when the elements that support their contentment, the marriage or the neighbors or the friendships or the family, start to deteriorate, as they will. Contentment has a static sound to it, doesn't it? It sounds like a kind of state of arrival or resolution. Okay, contentment. Boom. Done. Whew. But we know that life is not static. Reality is not static. It is flux. Life is flux. And as we said yesterday at the workshop, even if we were able to arrange our lives just the way we wanted them, with all the perfect elements of family, job, neighborhood, health, it won't stay that way. And this is the number one antidote to a kind of complacent, dead contentment. George Bernard Shaw said, "Satisfaction is death." But it's a tricky thing, because we all want to be satisfied. Who would not want contentment? So we want it, of course, but we just need to be clear that it's not going to last forever. And that awareness of impermanence, that awareness of the flux of life, is I think, arguably the greatest fuel for enlightenment, for deeper and deeper enlightenment, for spiritual progress. Oscar Wilde said, "Discontent is the first step in the progress of a person or nation." So we have the first of the Four Noble Truths. Life is suffering, or life is unsatisfying, ultimately. And it's the first of the Four Truths, because that's where practice begins. We have to feel some measure of dissatisfaction in order to evolve. Evolution doesn't happen if we're fat and happy. And that's the poignant fact of our striving for happiness, is to arrive at it, at even temporary contentment or happiness, is a dubious victory. But a real fundamental shift in one's spiritual life occurs when we come to understand that just that happiness is, all happiness is transitory. And that leads us to recognize that we can't count on happiness, worldly happiness, put it that way. We can't rely on worldly happiness for ultimate peace of mind. We have so many ways now in 21st century America to block out the basic certainty of death and the uncertainty of time of death. This is how Zen Master Dogen put it. This is probably the greatest engine of spiritual development, is awareness of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. But we have so many diversions, so many comforts, so many pleasures. As the Dalai Lama said, America has perfected samsara. We have so many ways to avoid this fact of impermanence and our mortality. Now more than ever, with all of the electronic devices that people are increasingly lashed to, attached to, where less and less space in the mind is available for simple reflection about these matters of impermanence and life and death. So whatever contentment or happiness we do achieve makes it all the more likely we're going to get attached to that state. And then attachment, as we know, attachment breeds suffering. And this is the really poignant thing about something like marital contentment, is the awareness that someday we'll be separated from our beloved. Trying to figure out who that was. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said, to love anything is to see it at once under the lowering clouds of danger. To love anyone is to see her or him under the lowering clouds of impermanence. It may be side effect of practice, or an effect, let's just say this, it may be an effect of practice that we become more aware of the eventual death of our loved ones. Certainly, I can say for myself, there's hardly a day that goes by that I don't have at least a fleeting, flickering thought of the fact that my wife and I will someday be apart. It's not something, practice, if it's working, does not leave us brooding about these things. Those who hear these, some people who hear this will think that, oh, what a morbid effect to think about death every day or every week. It's not thinking about it, and it's not dwelling on it. It's just, it's more from within, from the body. It's just a gut awareness. There's no other word for it. Gut awareness that this is fleeting. This is transient. That's a very balancing thing to have that, and can really enrich the relationship or whatever it is that one has. It's the awareness that because we're aware that it's fleeting, will pass, it becomes all that more precious. Now there, one can also arrive somewhat at this place of the awareness of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death, cognitively by sort of self-talk. There are actually Buddhist practice, a Buddhist practice. It's not something we do in Zen. But in other kinds of Buddhism, there's a practice where you really reflect on death as a practice, you know, maybe hours a day. I don't know about that. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's probably better than just going about one's life in ignorant bliss. But still, I think it's quite different from having practice reveal for us and confirm for us day in and day out this matter of impermanence. Then it's from the inside. It grows from within. And it's more in your tissues, this awareness of the impermanence of relationships and all these worldly things that we just read from David Brooks' column. Those things are fine as far as they go, but then we die. What about that? So we don't have to contrive to remind ourselves, I think. If we're practicing, we're practicing at least half an hour a day, and if more, all the better, then this seed of awareness, and to be human means to have that seed of awareness of our mortality, that seed will grow and grow and inform. It'll permeate our daily lives and our relationships with people more and more. Maybe never enough. If we were to recognize moment by moment in our interactions with people that person, as well as ourselves, but let's just say that person, is just passing like briefly through this life, then it would really affect, wouldn't it, positively our relationships and our develop greater patience and appreciation of each person. There's some quote that just is bubbling up to my mind right now, someone who said, imagine what would happen with your anger towards someone if the person suddenly died. Something, it's said better than that, but the idea is we can get so worked up in our petty quarrels and grievances. And I think for most of us, the prospect of that person or those people dropping dead all of a sudden would very abruptly change and neutralize our anger and our grievances. So there is probably no better antidote to kind of a dumb contentment than this awareness of the impermanence of things. But there are other antidotes. There is the awareness of others' suffering. How content can you be if you're aware of the boundless suffering in this world? You can't, can you? This is the vow of the Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva, for those of you who are brand new, Bodhisattva literally means a wisdom being, but it means one who, the technical definition, and there are different definitions, but the most common one you hear is one who postpones her or his own complete enlightenment in order to help others. One who postpones his entering nirvana in order to be of service to others. This is what's behind what we do every day, which we'll do in about half an hour, which is the four bodhisattva vows. All beings without number I vow to liberate. That this practice is not merely about our own self-improvement or our own self-satisfaction, but we do this in order to develop the wisdom and the compassion to be of service to others. So what a miserable little form of happiness it would be if we block out all of the things that are happening in the world and all of those who are suffering and ignore it all. But we don't even have to even so much be informed about the suffering in the world out there if we are aware of our own sufferings, form of sufferings. Self-knowledge is another antidote to contentment, a kind of static contentment that yields no further spiritual development. And this too, through practice, we become more and more keenly aware of the tiny little moment-by-moment forms of tightening and defending and other forms of pain that go on all the time in most of us that most people are unaware of. This suffering in general, the word we use is dukkha, or suffering or dissatisfaction. And the higher the quality of our zazen, our sitting, the more meticulously we become aware of these little forms of frustration. And that, for some people, is enough to keep them working and striving to go beyond themselves, beyond worldly forms of happiness. The Buddha offered up an analogy of how sensitive the degrees of sensitivity people may have to pain, and he said that there are those who reflect on the impermanence of life and the certainty of death only when they hear of the death of someone in the neighboring village. Or who may reflect on death when they hear of that. And there are others who are less sensitive, who only reflect on death and their own mortality when it's someone in their own village who dies. And then there are those who are still less sensitive, who won't consider this until someone in their own household dies. And then there are the least sensitive, or those who reflect on this only when they themselves are facing death, something like that. So the dissatisfaction with our life such as it is a great spur to practice. And not just practice for its own sake, but practice that will lead to liberation from this attachment to worldly happinesses. That's the ultimate release, the ultimate liberation. We devoted an issue in Zenbo to dukkha or dissatisfaction a few years ago. And I contributed a piece where I talked about how I feel I was blessed with a very happy upbringing and family life, but still there were enough little frustrations of daily life, little friction that seemed to be enough to get me to practice. The title of my article was "Hard Butter on Soft Bread," because this was the main form of dukkha that I was aware of when I was trying to spread hard butter on soft bread. Of course, there was so much more that I wasn't aware of that was working underneath all that. But as far as what we're consciously dissatisfied with, and they take almost comical, that kind of comical little things that for most people in the world it would just be a hoot to think that that's your source of suffering, or anything like that. Fill in the blanks. We all have these things. Zen Master Hakuin, whose chant in praise of Zazen we just recited a little while ago, he said, "No matter how little sickness there may be in one's body, there is pain in his heart because there is delusion in his mind. This is a chronic sickness of all sentient beings." What a blessing it is to be dissatisfied, really. Blessing in the big sense, in the long sense. No one would wish it on others or wish it on oneself, but when we find sources of dissatisfaction, of suffering, large or small, great or faint, when we find those things, then we do have a tremendous opportunity. And then, aside from the awareness of impermanence as an antidote to contentment, and the awareness of others' suffering, and our own awareness of our own suffering, there's just life itself. Change. Things that happen. Things that we encounter. The painful changes. The things that drop out of our lives. The losses. The most dramatic of these are things, of course, like the oil spill. What degree of contentment or satisfaction can we feel when we know what's happening in the Gulf these days, or what's happening in Afghanistan? Practice grows the awareness of these different forms of the sources of discontent. We become more finely attuned to pain, suffering in the world, our own and others. I've often been asked about a certain effect of practice where someone will report that she or he feels others' pain more acutely, and how painful that is as time goes on. But practice also grows contentment. There's the paradox. It's this dual effect of practice. We become more attuned to the suffering of life and ourself, and we become more stable and detached from it. This is the strange paradox of practice. If it were just feeling the pain of the world ever more acutely and more acutely and more acutely, good God, what kind of practice would that be? But there's this parallel development where we develop a detachment. We see the other side of it. We see that ultimately it is all this play of phenomena. And also through practice, we develop the ability to not brood about suffering and not dwell in the suffering of the world, because we become more fully present, directly aware of what's around us, to the degree that we are in touch with this, just the eating, just the walking, whatever the experience is right at this moment, to that degree we will not be bound to the suffering that comes from dwelling about suffering, thoughts of suffering. There's a famous Zen story that points to this. It comes from the Buddha. In one of his talks, he gave this parable. A man is walking across a field and he encounters a tiger. And of course, he flees and the tiger comes bounding after him. But all of a sudden, he comes to a precipice, a cliff, and he catches hold of a root of a vine and swings himself down over the edge of the cliff. Now the tiger comes up to the edge of the cliff and looks down at him and sniffing at him. And the man is trembling for his life, and he looks down far below, and there's another tiger waiting to eat him. And there he is, hanging from this vine. And then two mice, one white mouse and one black mouse, little by little start to gnaw away at the vine. One, by the way, just a little insertion here. I've heard this, the two mice referring to life and death, the awareness of life and death. So these two mice begin gnawing away at the vine, and then suddenly the man sees a luscious strawberry hanging there over the edge, and letting go of the vine, he still holds on with one hand. He plucks the strawberry with the other. How sweet it tasted. So we can't stop the mice from gnawing away the vine of our life. We can't even stop the tigers and dragons and other things, but we can find a way to not dwell on these things and be so thoroughly engaged with our lives that we find right there a richness, a wonder of with life just as it is, the dailiness of life, that the matter of life and death ceases to be a problem. But so long as it is a problem, then we really have to face it, or it just creates other problems. By suppressing our awareness of our mortality, we just invite more problems. We have to accept ourselves just where we are. If we're contented with our life, we don't need to beat ourselves up for that and think, oh, this is an impediment to my further evolution, spiritual evolution, and maybe I should go out and try to make myself miserable. That's ridiculous. But neither should we feel we have to apologize for having this basic anxiety about our own eventual death. I once read a dialogue where a Zen master asked the monk, "Are you afraid to die?" And the monk said, no, I'm really not. And the master said, "Well, then, you really won't go very far without the fear of death." But with the fear of death, with the awareness of impermanence and suffering, we can go far enough to transcend that. And I want to read a wonderful story, a true story, about two Chinese, great Chinese masters. I'll use their Japanese names. These are Chinese, but Seppo and Ganto. Seppo was the elder of the two, and Seppo was the younger of the two, and he looked to Ganto as his as sort of his elder brother. And once these two were traveling and were caught in a snowstorm, Ganto, that's the older one, he took it easy and slept away his days, while Seppo, the one who was less experienced in practice, still hadn't come to awakening, spent his time sitting and doing zazen. One day, Seppo, the younger one, tried to wake up Ganto from his sleep. He said, "Elder brother, get up!" Ganto said, "Why should I?" And Seppo was annoyed, and he said, "In this present life, why am I so unlucky to be traveling with a fellow like this who just..." Excuse me, I'm getting mixed up here with this. Seppo, the younger one, who is still striving for enlightenment, says, "In this present day, why am I so unlucky to be traveling with a fellow like this who just drags me down like a piece of luggage? Ever since we arrived here, he has been doing nothing but sleeping." And that was enough for Ganto. He shouted, "Shut up and go to sleep. You spend every day sitting cross-legged on the bed. You're like an idol in the shrine of a common village. In the future, you will be bedeviling the sons and daughters of good families." That means it's a way of saying monks and nuns. And then the younger one, he pointed to his own heart, and he said, "Here within me, I feel no peace. I dare not deceive myself." And then Ganto was very much surprised to hear him speak like this. And then Seppo said, the younger one said, he felt an inner restlessness. And then the older one, Ganto, related to him some of his own experiences. He asked the younger one to relate his own his experiences, and so that the older one could sift the genuine from the false. And Seppo, the younger one, told him how he had entered the first gate. He had had an initial kensho under such and such a master. And other things. And finally the older one said, "What are you talking about?" And he shouts, "Haven't you heard that he who enters by the door is not the treasure of his own house?" And then Seppo, the younger one, says, "From now on, what shall I do?" And Ganto said, "Hereafter, if you want to transmit the great teaching, let everything flow from your own heart and let it cover and permeate the sky and the earth." And at these words, Seppo was thoroughly awakened. So you see here the two cases. One, the more advanced, more deeply enlightened, who had come to accept that everything just as it is reality, it's the truth. He had arrived at this place of great peace of mind, deep concurrence with life, with all of its suffering, and had acquired a profound serenity as a result of his own striving, his own tremendous exertions for years and years. But it had left him with this state of contentment. The other one hadn't got there yet, until after this through the help of the older one, then he reached it himself. So it's not a matter of happiness or contentment being good or bad. It just is what it is. But should we find ourselves our happiness or contentment shaken, then we can certainly see it as a great opportunity. I experienced this myself, was reminded of this myself recently with this business about Sevan. Okay, there goes the contentment. plenty of work still to do. And this is what we encounter, the Zen teachers encounter in our annual meetings. The week after this coming week, we're hosting the annual Zen teachers meeting out at Chapin Mill. And I think a lot of teachers don't, let's put it this way, a lot of us don't look forward with unalloyed joy at the prospect of getting together with our colleagues, because to do so means to become aware of ways in which we are still deficient. You hear about what other teachers are doing, what's happening at their centers. I think every teacher, every honest teacher would say that you leave that meeting thinking, oh, there's so much more I could do. You get good ideas. And then when you realize that there may be things worth trying, then you can improve. You can go beyond yourself. In fact, my sitting here in this position right now in Taisho, this far from the altar, is an idea that I picked up in one of these teachers' meetings. My teacher and his teachers would sit much closer to the altar as if addressing the Buddha, presenting one's understanding to the Buddha. But I think for us Westerners, this is a better arrangement, is to be farther back. So I'm also addressing the Sangha, the people who are here. That's just a tiny example of the kind of reflection and reconsidering of things that we can get from being hearing about other ways of doing things. Well, I think I've this is all kind of unspooled far enough, and our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.